Good morning, I'm Donna Quinn, and for the next half hour, you'll be listening to Talk of Our Towns. My guest today is Portland author Laura Messersmith-Glavin, whose latest book, Spirit Things, is a perfect gem. Just published by University of Alaska Press, the book is a collection of essays exploring the secret history, science, and mythology of objects on a fishing boat in Alaska. The Anchorage Daily News named it a book to love and cherish. Indeed, it is. Laura is well known at Astoria Fisher Poets Gathering. She began her fishing career in the salmon fleet around Kodiak Island, Alaska, at the tender age of 2, on a boat named the Laura Lee. Laura's parents, Jan and Stephanie Messersmith, were renowned fisher people in Alaska's dangerous waters for decades. Today, Laura is a writer, educator, and performer based in Portland, Oregon. It is my honor to have Laura, queen of pirates.net, on the program today. Good morning, Laura.
Good morning, Donna. Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
I'm thrilled. I loved your book, and it defies any genre that I can think of. And I know our listening audience is going to really enjoy hearing your thoughts about the book and many other things. To put things into context, why don't we begin with a little bit about your background and history? Although, of course, that is throughout the book too.
Yeah. So my parents were, neither one is from Alaska originally. They were from Indiana and Washington respectively. And they met in Alaska in the early 60s and they worked together in canneries and other contexts until they had their own boat. And they fished both on Kodiak Island and out in Dutch Harbor and on Alaska for many years before I was born. And then I started going on the boat when I was 2 years old, and I started working on deck when I was 8, primarily salmon seining around Kodiak Island. And then I retired at the ripe old age of 21 to go and pursue other things. But Alaska has continued to inform both my creative work and, you know, my approach to how I see the world in a lot of ways, definitely shaped my work ethic, among other things.
And being 2 years old on a fishing boat in a dangerous place, did you realize as a child growing up how unusual, how unique your childhood was?
I think to a certain extent I did. It was much more salient to me when I was other places. When I was in Alaska, that seemed completely normal. You know, it was like, this is what one does. One looks at grizzly bears off the deck and one knows how to clean a fish and one wears a life jacket 24/7. You know, these things were just the way that life was. But when we were other places, like when I went to school in Southern Indiana and then in Eastern Oregon, my particular skill set was pretty strange there. And the fact that we lived half the year in one place and half the year in the other kind of gave me this sense of a dual life. And so I always felt like I was kind of being tugged between worlds because the Alaska world was so different than the landlocked one.
Trying to figure out who you were and where home was, that's also a theme in the book. There's a lot of philosophical wondering and why did you name it Spirit Things? What made you decide to write this book?
Well, I talk about this a little bit in the first chapter, but there was this amazing native boat builder on Spruce Island named Ed Opheim. And he kind of charged me with the task solemnly when I was about 11 years old. The salmon fishing industry has changed so much over, you know, the past decades. And I think that I was born at a really unique moment before, there's kind of a before and after. And I was born sort of right at the cusp of a lot of technological and policy changes. And so this man sort of invested in me the charge to write the stories as they used to be. You know, he said, you're the one, you're the youngest one who remembers the way things were. And so you need to tell the stories. And I accepted that charge very solemnly and completely panicked and had no idea what that would look like. And as I got older and started writing and producing my own work, I actually avoided writing about Alaska for a very long time, partly because I felt like I didn't know the stories that I was supposed to tell. when I would hear my parents tell stories, you know, they knew all of the names and they remembered all of the people, and they had these very exciting, you know, the kinds of sea stories that you expect from lifetime fishermen. And that just wasn't what my memories looked like. My memories were often quiet things. I have a, kind of a preoccupation with sensory details in my life generally. And I found that when I reached for memories, what I often recalled most clearly were objects, like a knife or something about a net or something about a glove, something about a fish. And so when I finally decided to pull my Fisher Poets writing into a collection, I was looking for a way that I could find a meaningful, kind of a way to tie all of those memories together that felt true to my own experience. It wasn't about these big flashy sea stories. It was about how meaning comes from these immediate things. And so I decided to dwell on objects. There's another kind of aspect to fishing life, which is that it's sort of atomized, right? We're all on different boats, and communication between other fisher people is sporadic, often done through the radio. And I felt like I was having this very obviously profound experience living on the water, and yet I couldn't figure out what it meant. I didn't have any real framework for understanding the kind of cultural implications, or like, what was I supposed to know about the world based on these experiences? And so when I went to sit down and recast these essays, I asked myself, okay, well, what if those teachers that I was looking for, the cultural transmission I was looking for, what if that was located in the objects themselves? And so I kind of asked each of these things, you know, the salmon and the wave and the glove and the knot, like, what do you have to teach me? I think the focusing on objects is a big part of my approach in general. I think that, you know, when we think about memoir, often people are preoccupied with this idea of it being a story with a beginning and a middle and an end. But when I think about my own memories, or when I think about my own life, it doesn't feel like that at all. It doesn't feel linear in any way. It feels like a web, or like a spiral, or like an explosion. And when I use these objects to focus on, it enables me to kind of use that as a almost like a meditation, and then look at all of the different ways that these things can interconnect in the same moment. Like I sometimes with my students, because I teach creative writing at Portland Community College, I'll have them do an exercise where I'll just ask them to grab an object close to them, something that they actually use. So say, Donna, for instance, you might pick up your pencil. So this is a pencil that you use. What aspects of your life can you investigate just by asking this pencil about itself? Like, maybe you chew on it and it has those bumps on it, and that reveals something about your anxieties or your habits. Or maybe you ask yourself, where does the wood come from? Well, we'll do a little research and discover that pencils are made from incense cedar, which is grown on the east side of Mount Hood. And so immediately we're thinking about our natural environment and the resources around us. Or maybe we'll look at our handwriting and we'll notice how it changes with mood or topic. Or there's a million different things that we can investigate just by looking at this one object. And then suddenly we're able to see how our lives are these rich interconnections and collisions of all of the different aspects of things that like influence us and shape our worlds. And that to me feels like the way I experience life. That to me feels like the way I experience my memories. So I focus on objects so that I can go in all of these directions at once. And it gives me a lot of room to investigate.
Yes, I love the cover of the book of a rusty knife. And would you like to read us something from the book? I mean, I want to also say that I could not pick out which of my favorites. I loved all of these. Shell was particularly meaningful. Food. You don't think about how is food being cooked on the boat. Your mother, how she was able to create these, you know, beautiful little altars of throughout the boat. I mean, it's just quite brilliant. So please read us something.
Yeah, I'd love to. So one of the things that I talk a lot about in the boat is just what it feels like to live on and near water all the time. And when I was really small, this was kind of a frightening thing. I think that sometimes people assume that when you live on the water, there's kind of this, you know, huzzah, like piracy kind of vibe to it. And everyone is you know, in love with the ocean and things. And when I was little, it was actually very anxiety producing. And so this is a little bit, about that. This is from the chapter on wave. When we anchored up at night in a bay or lagoon protected from the swell, I would listen to the water lapping against the fiberglass hull by my head. Some nights, the gentle slosh and lick was another comfort, a rhythmic patter like slow rain. But most nights, that sound whispered to me, invoking darkness far denser and frightening than the sky could hold. It was a cold sound, a reaching one. Every wavelet felt like a hand snaking up from the depths to taunt me, striking against the hull right where my face, my torso, and limbs were on the other side. Rather than reminding me of the safety of the boat, the sounds at the waterline accentuated the thinness of the barrier between my body and the impossible depths that lay below it. As if the waves were only toying with us, great hands gently rolling an egg back and forth between their palms. At any moment, they could crush our protective shell at will. Slap, slosh, slap. Those sounds pulled me to sleep at night, downward, so that rest became an act of surrender to a great bottomless fear.
And it was, how many of you were on the boat? How many of you were living that experience? And of course, everyone's experience was different.
Sure. Yeah. So my parents, my dad was the skipper, my mom was the cook, and she also worked on deck. And then we had a skiff man who would run the other boat that holds the other end of the net. If you're not familiar with the seine operation, there's the main boat, and then there's a quarter mile seine, and then there's another smaller boat that kind of holds the end of that net and then pulls the larger boat around it as we pull it in. And then we would generally have one other deckhand, although sometimes when I was younger, we would have two other deckhands. But once I was old enough to be a full deckhand, we would generally just have one other person.
Very hard work. Physically demanding, and you talk about that, and also you and your mother in a male dominated industry. How was that?
You know, it was always a really interesting thing. It is hard work, and it's constant work. It's kind of hard to imagine the hours. Often, you know, we would get up sometimes at 4 a.m. and we'd be out on the fishing grounds, and we would work until sometimes as late as like 10 o'clock or later. And then we would go and deliver fish and anchor up and have a few hours of sleep and go back and do it again. Sometimes when the fish were really running, you don't stop at all. You know, you keep going. And so there's a relentlessness to that kind of work. You know, we would nap on the fly sometimes, or one time I woke up on deck and realized that I had fallen asleep and my knees had hit the hatch covers, and I like stood up again. And so, you know, when I say that it really affected my work ethic, it's kind of an overdeveloped sense of, of like labor responsibility there. Like one time when I was first married, we were moving and I had kind of gone into like fishing mode, and I was like hauling boxes and running in and out of the house as fast as I could. And my partner was moving at about half the same speed. And finally I was like, come on, let's go. And he was like, I'm not a fisherman. Don't yell at me. And so it's definitely unlike other ways of being. But my mom and I, you know, we were the only women on our boat. Occasionally we had women crew, but often women would have boats of their own. So a woman skipper would hire an all women crew, and they would be safer that way, more comfortable that way for a lot of different reasons. But it was also kind of a point of pride. Like once I was strong enough to do the harder jobs on the boat, for instance, when you stack the net, there's a cork pile and there's a lead pile. The leads are much, much heavier. And, you know, by the time I was 15 or 16, I was making sure that I was the one stacking the lead pile, and I would make the man, whoever else was working on deck, do the corks, just because I wanted to do the stronger job. And so, you know, we were proud of what we were able to do. And it definitely helped shape my sense of capacity, right? That there really isn't a gender to strength. And I was always really, I always admired all of the women who ran boats as well, because it was hard for them.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Talk of Our Towns. Today, my guest is Portland author Laura Messersmith-Glavin, whose latest book, Spirit Things, is a perfect gem. Honestly, this book appeals to everyone. It's memoir, it's philosophy, it's poetry. I can't imagine anyone who wouldn't absolutely love this book. It's a collection of essays exploring the secret history, science, and mythology of objects on a fishing boat in Alaska. And it's about life. The Anchorage Daily News named it a book to love and cherish. Laura is well known at Astoria Fisher Poets Gathering. She began her fishing career in the salmon fleet around Kodiak Island at the tender age of 2 on a boat named the Laura Lee. Laura's parents, Jan and Stephanie Messersmith, were renowned fisher people in Alaska's dangerous waters for decades. Today, Laura is a writer, educator, and performer based in Portland, Oregon. Queenofpirates.net. Why did you choose queenofpirates.net?
You know, I have had that Queen of Pirates name for over 20 years, maybe 25 years. I snagged it as an early email address, and now I can never change my email because I will never get it back. But it comes from, you know, a kind of a typical crazy Kodiak story where there was a wild night. I think it was the 4th of July, and a bunch of people got crazy and somebody ended up stealing a skiff and taking it for a joyride. And we all had kind of a pirate night. And so the idea of Queen of Pirates was a way for me to take that kind of sense of lawlessness with me, and also to keep the boat life with me and the rest of the world. You know, sometimes, you know, we talked about how different the Alaska world is from all of the other worlds that I've inhabited. And sometimes it's easy to feel like those parts of me are invisible, you know, in Portland. It's like, nobody needs me to tie a really cool knot, you know, nobody needs me to lift anything that heavy. And so it's nice to have that aspect of my identity reflected, even if it's just through my website.
What do you miss about that world? One of the things I'd really like you to talk about is this idea of our longing for home. Mm-hmm. And what we miss. And you did a lot of research in this book too. I mean, I learned about, you know, the cultures which could know where they were in the ocean just by the feel of the waves, how they think of it as a grid and how it's an energy grid. I mean, it was so educational and informational, but this idea of longing for home. And could you talk to us about that, please?
Yeah, I think that this is not an experience unique to Alaska or to fishing. I mean, certainly I am the product of an industry that has changed. You know, I have not been back to Alaska since 2005, when I went to Kodiak for the funeral of a dear friend of mine who died in a crabbing accident. But you know, so it's been a long time since I have been up there. And I know that there are many aspects of the industry I would not even recognize any longer. You know, there were no cell phones when I was there, for instance. And I know the ways people communicate has changed. But I think that when we think about home, there's always this question of like, well, what has made us who we are? What are these ineffable things that have shaped us? And when I miss Alaska, it's craving what those formative feelings were, even if they weren't actually a place or actually a thing. I miss the fact that I used to stare out at the water for countless hours and be kind of overwhelmed by the water horizon and that feeling of the infinite. I miss the ways in which it would never get dark in the middle of summer, and that would give it would kind of erase all the boundaries on time. And it would make me feel like, you know, I was kind of part of this infinite space. Like there was always this hugeness to the experience. If you have never been to Alaska, it is wild in a way that most of us do not have access to in the lower 48 or even elsewhere in the world. And I don't just mean the animals, right? Like, of course, there's grizzly bears and there are bald eagles as common as pigeons and all of these things. But it's more that the feeling of the place is not yet trampled by human contact. And when you're there, it feels completely indifferent to you, to humans, to their existence. And that is an amazing feeling. That is a rare feeling. And I miss that. I miss being reminded of the vastness of the world, and the fact that there are still places that we cannot touch. I think in this time of climate catastrophe and all of the environmental degradation that is taking place, that we have wrought through our economic systems, I think that being reminded that the world and the natural world exists and all of that richness is a really important kind of piece of hope.
Yes, and you actually address so many things in the book, and I would like to ask how your life is now, how all of that informs how you live now and what you do. Clearly, as a child, you were in Alaska all summer fishing, then you lived in Eastern Oregon where you went to school, mm-hmm. and such, you know, different ways of being in the world, the land and the water. And how does this affect your work today? Tell us a little bit about what is, and you're doing readings right now, you're composing, you're working with musicians. I really encourage people to go to your website, queenofpirates.net, because that will let our listening audience know where you're going to be, what you're going to be doing, over these next many months. So how is it today in your world?
Well, I think that a lot of those details of Alaska, it's all been kind of absorbed at this point. Like I don't think about Alaska every day. And I think that's really important just to mention about my work in general, is I didn't write this to be an Alaska book. And in fact, that's why there's a knife on the cover. I said, whatever you do, do not put a boat on the cover. This is not about boats. It's not about fishing. This is about how we understand the world and our lives. And I feel like that has come across much better, and that's why the knife is on the cover. But I think the lasting impact of Alaska, besides kind of the work ethic and the love for the natural world and the fascination with things that are vast and big, has just been like really understanding that there are so many different worlds that we inhabit, and wanting to find as many of them, touch as many of them, like explore as many of them as I can, like all at once. And I'm a mother now as well. And my child, I was given this remarkable opportunity to inhabit this really unusual world and to explore risk and danger and wildness. And it reminds me that those are essential experiences. And, I try to find those for my child as well, find opportunities for them both to touch the natural world in that really profound way and also to learn to find their own ways through risk. As an artist, I am trying to say yes to everything. I recently, sometimes as, through Fisher Poets, I've been kind of branded as the water poet, which is funny because I don't think of myself as a poet at all. I think of myself as an essayist, but I had the opportunity to work with a jazz sextet called Tunnel Six, and I wrote the libretto for their suite, The Columbia River. I've been lecturing in classrooms. I love working with book groups, so if any book group wants to read Spirit Things and they would like me to come and talk or run a writing workshop, I'm always happy to do things like that. This book is about connection, and it's about the ways in which we can all find that resonance through authenticity, and all of the many, many aspects of our lives that fascinate and inform us.
Laura, we only have a few minutes left. I could talk to you about so many things. Do you want to read anything else for us? Do you want to tell us anything else that perhaps we haven't talked about? We could talk for a much longer period of time, and hopefully we'll do that again.
Sure. I will end with just a very small little piece from the chapter on light. There is a light that is neither day nor night, a long stretch of purple that fades into morning, the color of driftwood. This purple space carries us from one day to the next without rest, a slow alarm like the arrival of waves. It is ceaseless, cyclic blooming and fading, the depths of the dark only a brief opportunity to see those more distant lights of stars, of the magnetic fields dancing at the poles. These glimmers remind me that we are always in darkness. Darkness is the state around us, and it is only the bounce of energy that renders things sensible. Without our eyes, what is the meaning of light?
Yes, and I, in the Shell chapter, and I learned about the fact that, you know, there is no real boundary between, you know, the ocean and the edge there, the way you described that. I hadn't ever thought about it like that.
The liminal zone, right? The idea that there's the land and the water, but that line is always changing. Yeah, I love that idea a lot.
Yes. And we were going to talk a little bit about synesthesia. We have so many other things to talk about. Unfortunately, we don't have time to do all that right now. So we'll do this again. But I really appreciate you making time out of your busy schedule to talk with us today and to let everyone know about how objects can inform us, can teach us, can be sacred.
Yes, and this idea that our lives are not told in terms of a beginning and a middle and an end. We can be all of these things all at once. Yeah, thank you so much for the chance to share. This has been really fun.
Oh, thank you so much, Laura. And if you would like to learn more about where Laura will be and what she is doing, you can go to her website, queenofpirates.net. And she, you're also doing some editorial work too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I work for the Institute for Anarchist Studies and their journal Perspectives on Anarchist Theory, and also writing all the time. Got a couple more books in the works.
So. Yes, thank you. Wonderful. Something to look forward to. To me, it just is a perfect book. So thank you so much for giving that gift to us.
Thank you so much, Donna. It's been a pleasure.
I want to express my gratitude to Graham for engineering today, and also thanks to local talented banjo instructor Michael Bruin for his original theme music for this program. Until we meet again, Talk of Our Towns is the first Thursday of each month at 9 a.m. But in between that time, I hope that every day we will stop, and let's just do that right now. Let's stop and take a very deep breath together. It is so good for body, mind, and spirit. And then with gratitude, focus on the things that are going well in your life. There will always be those things that aren't going well. Focus on the things that are with gratitude, and then give yourself a loving and compassionate hug or a pat on the back for being uniquely you. For doing the best you can. Everyone is until we know better. And for being here now, in this moment, the only moment that exists, the now moment, on the amazing planet we call Earth.